Hello, hello, and welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas here at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. And welcome to the Perimeter Institute's public lecture series presented by Sun Life Financial. My name is Greg Dick. I'm the Director of Educational Outreach here at Perimeter, and it is a sincere pleasure to welcome everyone here today, both those of you here in the live studio audience and those of you tuning in on our website or on one of the many science communication colleagues' websites around the globe. The lecture itself will last approximately 1 hour, and there will be question and answer following. For those of you online, Dr. Kelly Foyle and her team of PI researchers and two guests from University of Waterloo's Water Institute are behind their keyboards in the chat zone, ready to engage in conversation throughout the lecture, answering questions and debating what you're hearing. If you want to engage in that conversation, use hashtag PI Live. And also, I'll try to take a question or two from the Twitter feed at the end. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's very special guest speaker, Dr. Marcia Barbosa. Dr. Barbosa is the director of the Physics Institute at the Federal University of Rio Grande in southern Brazil. She is a member of the Council of the American Physical Society and a member of the Brazilian Academy of Sciences. She was awarded the prestigious 2013 L'Oréal UNESCO Prize for Women in Physics for her work on water anomalies, and in 2010, she was awarded the Nicholson Medal from the American Physical Society for her work on gender studies. Throughout her career, Dr. Barbosa has sought to unlock the mysteries of water's anomalies, initially from a theoretical perspective, and then focusing her insights on practical applications in the medical and life sciences. Tonight, she will discuss how decoding the strange properties of water may be essential to resolving the increasing stress on our global water supply. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dr. Marcia Barbosa.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I am fascinated by water. Do you know why? Because water is bipolar. No, don't panic and stop drinking your water thinking that your water is sick. I mean bipolar because for certain pressures and temperatures, water is just normal as any other material. But then, in a certain range of pressure and temperature, it goes bananas. It does everything different from the other materials. And do you know what? We live in the range of pressures and temperatures in which water is crazy. I have been studying water for the last 15 years of my life, and tonight I'm going to try to convince you that we can use the craziness of water to make more fresh water for us. But before doing that, I challenge you to look to this picture on the screen, in which we have a photograph taken by my good friend Daisy Costa. She didn't take that in Brazil because, of course, we don't have icebergs in Brazil. She went all the way to South Argentina in a place, beautiful place, almost as beautiful as Waterloo, a beautiful place called Patagonia. And you can see here a puzzle. You see water in solid, liquid, and vapor existing in our planet. I challenge you to think in another material that you can see living together in our planet in the three states, not in a lab, in the planet. And that's a challenge for you. While you think about this challenge, let's go to the roadmap of this talk. So the first thing a scientist does is to bring a problem. So what's the problem I'm bringing tonight to you? But then the second thing every scientist should care about is why should care about these problems? There are many problems in life. For instance, I don't know the difference between right and left. But I don't care. It's not something that I care. Probably people that are giving me directions, they care, but I don't care. Okay? But there are problems that you should care, and water is one problem you should care. So what the clues? You know, scientists are detectives. So I'm going to show you some clues about the solution of this problem. I'm going to highlight some current methods for getting fresh water, and I'm going to challenge you to dream about new methods using the craziness of water. First thing, look to the planet. Our planet is covered, 70% of the surface of Earth is covered with water. Now take all this water, put in a huge tank, like the tank I'm illustrating in this picture. If I do that, 97.5% of this tank is filled with salt water. Okay? So all this huge amount of water is salt water that we cannot drink, that you cannot use for the plants. Just the tip of this tank, this little tip on the top, you see a tip, very little one, that have just 2.5% of the water. Just that is fresh water. Now, let's zoom it to this tip. You see this huge circle there, and you're seeing that in this circle, that's just 2.5% of the whole water in the planet, most of the water is outside. It's frozen. Okay, you cannot use for plant, you cannot use for drinking, and probably when it melts, it just goes to the salt water. You know, if the North Pole melts, you know, it just goes to the sea and not to our house to have drink water, so it's a disaster. Then you have this, all this green part that's underneath water. That's very hard to get. Actually, in my country, Brazil, you have the two biggest resources. One is aquifers Guarani that have lots of water underneath, a kilometer underneath. And just this tiny, tiny dark blue is the easy water. Okay, so we see that we're talking about very little easy water. And we are talking about something that's constant. You understand? It's not going to increase, is it? Is that what you have? However, and there is always however in life, the population is growing, and the population that wants access to water is growing. I have a scientist, very famous biochemist, Nina Fedorov, that says, soon we are going to have 10 billion people for dinner. How can we feed them? And I add to that, how can you give them water to drink? But worse than that, because the majority of water, 66% of the water you use for food, we have a big problem, because to prepare dinner, we need the plants, we need the animals, and all then they consume water. And not to be mean to you, I have an addition to that. In this food 66%, I'm including the plantations that we are doing to get ethanol. The core that we are not eating, you're planting to get gas. The huge plantations of sugar cane in Brazil, in which we are planting not to eat, but to get gas. So also we have to think about how we are going to bring the 10 billion people to our home. What water we'll be producing to get the plantations so we can get the gas. Then we have the domestic 10%, so please don't stop showering to save water because it's just 10%. The industry 20%, and part of that evaporates. So we have a problem, and I hope I have convinced you. The population is increasing, the water is not increasing. But let's see what I call stress. You know, it's not me, who am I, you know. It's the powerful, you know, UN, UNESCO people that design a map, and I'm going to show this map over the time, and I just want to pay attention that More blue means that you have a better ratio between need of water and having water. And this picture is from the 50s. And I can see many smiling faces for Canada because Canada is dark blue. Good for you. Then, you know, times pass, and this same picture in 95 have changed. You're seeing much less dark blue and much more red in the planet. And finally, the prospection for 2025 is bad. We have a lot of red, you know, and I can see again happy faces in Canada because Canada is still is dark blue. But this is a picture of average. There is no bigger lie than average. Because this picture is showing my country, Brazil, with really dark blue. However, at this very moment we were speaking, the whole state of São Paulo, the biggest population in Brazil, have stress of water. How come? A country that has a lot of water, but the water is not equally distributed. By the way, this is the state that produces half of the sugar cane for moving cars in Brazil. Okay? So we have a problem. You should care about this problem. And the biggest reason why you should care about this problem, actually, I do care about this problem, is because 70% of me and you is water. And in the year 2050, probably one of two people will have stress of water. I'm choosing at the moment me, sorry for you. So now we have to think about how to get more water. But before doing that, let me introduce you to water. And that's just a cartoon in which is designed the oxygen of water as red and the two hydrogens as white. And that's completely inappropriate cartoon because oxygen is much bigger than the hydrogen. So it should be bigger. So imagine this bigger. It has six electrons in the valence layer, and the electrons like to be paired, and they want to make eight. So the way they handle that is that they get two pair here, and then one in this way, and one in this way. And then they nicely invite the poor hydrogen that just have one electron to share. Remember when you were in the, you know, primary school and you have this nice, bigger, stronger friend that wants to share lunch with you, 90% to them and 10% to you, is basically that. And because of that, something very magic occurs. Most simple molecules, they are aligned like that. But because the two electrons are here, they form this covalent bond that will be like this way. And because it's this way, you get polarized, locally polarized. You see, you have more minus, it's, you know, this big oxygen is pulling the electrons, so there's more electrons in the oxygen. The poor hydrogen is there positively. But however, because you have this polarization, you end up attracting the neighbor molecule. It's a very tricky way to attract because, you see, in this side, oxygen, you know, it's oxygen is negative. You have the poor hydrogen isolated with this, almost without the electron. But it's looking to the other oxygen there that's also negative, and you make this bond. This is not a covalent bond. The covalent bond is strong. It's 20 times stronger than this slashed bond that's called hydrogen bond. So the hydrogen bond is very picky. It's very picky because it's derived for a polarization that requires a very specific direction. Once you move a little bit, the other molecules see the other pluses around, so it has to be aligned in that specific way. And also the distance. The distance has to be that distance. Not closer, not further, exactly that distance. Now you're going to see how it goes. Remember, I have these two pairs happily that push charges in this way. And I have my hydrogens. And my hydrogens are bonding to other oxygens. But then in the other side, I have these two electrons bonding to other hydrogens, and then each molecule make four hydrogen bonds. And sorry for the picture, this picture makes everything in the plane, so I'm going to tell you exactly how it works. Imagine a cube, okay? Imagination, a cube around me. I'm going to put my feet in one of the corners, and my other feet in the other corners, in the diagonal of the square that's just underneath my feet. Then I put my arms like that, and that's the hydrogen bonding of water. And that's the way water likes to be, you know, very fancy like that. So most of the time, water is bonding like that. Is strong? No. 20 times weaker than the covalent. So I like to compare. Covalent bond is like marriage. It's supposed to be forever, okay? Things have changed, but it's supposed to be forever. But hydrogen bonds are flirting. So even though they want to be all the time with four neighbors, the four neighbors change. You know, if you're in a party, you're flirting, and then you're flirting, and then you're flirting. All the time flirting. But the partners change all the time. That's why it's such a movable particle. So I think, more or less, you got the idea. But when you make it ice, it's like Lego. You have this tetramer, you know, and you can combine in many ways. So ice have many formats, but all the formats have all hydrogen bonds make it. So it's a structure of hydrogen bonds. And remember, the hydrogen bonds require space, and then they will be more open structure. Okay, I think we are very, very familiar with water. Now I'm going to tell you some of the craziness of water. I might tell that today we know 72 crazy things of water, and it's still going on, you know. But tonight, unfortunately, I'm just going to keep simple. I'm going to talk about density anomaly, heat capacity, diffusion, water superflow, and about some materials that love water and other materials that hate water. Okay, let's start again with my picture of my good friend. And the astonishing thing about this picture is not only that we have the three states altogether, but the fact that the solid phase is floating in the liquid phase. And why this is so astonishing? Because in any other material, you decrease the temperature and the material start to shrink because we are accommodate to more organized structure, and more organized structure usually is shrinking. Shrinking means that the density goes up. And you know that the density goes up means that you go down, you know. And think about metal. Think about a movie scene, because you don't see liquid metal every day, but a movie scene in which you see metal in liquid metal. What's going to happen? It's going to sink. For those ones with my age group, they will remember Terminator, in the film in which Arnold Schwarzenegger jumps in liquid metal, and it sinks. If it would be made of ice, it would float. The end of the film would be completely different. Anyway, ice floats in water. And this is unusual, okay? Now I'm going to explain where water is normal and where water is crazy. And if you see this picture, we have regions in which the water temperature changes from 4 centigrades to 8 centigrades. And in this direction, 4 to 8, water is in normal range. Not crazy, normal. Means that the density at 4 centigrades is bigger than the density at 8 centigrades. So you have the bottom water 4 and the top water 8. And if you're lucky enough to be in Brazil, the top water will be 26. Okay? Anyway, but in this other side of the picture, we have 0 centigrades water floating in 4 centigrades water. Because as you decrease the temperature of water, water, instead of doing this, water wants to make all the hydrogen bonds. So water does that. And because it does that, you see that you go up, and the things start to be less and less dense. And if you put ice on top, ice is even less dense. So ice floats into 0 centigrades water, while you have this comfortable 4 centigrades water in the bottom. Now you see crazy region, non-crazy region. But in the crazy region, it's very important. It's very important because if ice would not float in water, each winter here in Canada, we are going to froze the lakes and river from bottom to top and kill everything. You know, I tried to explain that in Brazil. It's very hard. They never saw ice in the rivers, etc. And they don't care if, you know, in other places they will kill all the rivers. But then I give another example that I think is pretty convincing. At some point in Earth, we have all frozen. And we still have life because we have this cup, you know, of ice, and inside we have this warm 4 centigrades water that made possible for us to keep life. So the craziness of water helps us to be alive today. Okay, and just to explain the same thing, but now with a cartoon inside, in which I illustrate that this combination of network that you call tetramers of water can be in two different arrangements. One that is very tight arrangement, no bounds, and one further away arrangement with bounds. So I give temperature, I break the bonds, I do that. Okay? That's no other material will do. Now let's go to heat capacity. Heat capacity measures how much heat I give, how much temperature I get. So if a material have a very high heat capacity, means that I have to give lots of heat to increase a little bit the temperature, or takes a lot of heat to decrease a little bit the temperature. Water have a very high heat capacity, unlike silicon. I'm putting the two values there. You can see that water have 4 times the heat capacity for silicon. If I am putting the picture of a beach and, you know, a sea in the beach, just to illustrate the difference you find when you go to the beach. The beach in Brazil is very, the sand is very bright, and you have the ocean there. And if you go in a normal day, your feet are going to burn in the sand because the sand is very hot. The water is 26 centigrades. That's not that hot for Brazil. So, quite that, you have the, and if you go in the evening, you go, a lot of people go in the evening to the beach, the sand will be cold, but the water is keep on being 26 centigrades. And the reason for that is very hard to change the temperature of water. You have to give lots of heat because of this huge heat capacity, what's not the same as silicon. And why should I care about that? I care about that because we are 70% of water. And because of that, because of this huge heat capacity, our body temperatures is easier to control. We have a lot of mechanisms for that, but it's easier to control and not having fluctuating, you know, from very hot to very cold. So heat capacity high is very important for us, but also is very important for the planet. Remember, 70% of the planet is covered with water. And the water, even though crosses from one place to another, the changes of temperature is not that high. So you have this huge heat reservoir in water. Again, a crazy thing that help us to be alive. Now, sorry, I'm bringing a graph. I know that in public lectures you should avoid that, but, you know, it's my graph, so it's my baby. Don't complain about it. And that's the reason why I got the prize, so I have to show everywhere. And, you know, what this graph is showing is something very intriguing about water. It's showing the diffusion coefficient. What the hell is this? Diffusion coefficient is ability of move. Bigger diffusion coefficient, move more. Lower diffusion coefficient, move less. So what you know about any other material, including ourselves, when you have something that have more dense, like more people, it's harder to move, much harder to move. More cars, harder to move. Less car, easier to move. Less people, easier to move. And water does exactly like that in this region. You know, in this region here, if you increase density, more people, more cars, the diffusion goes down. And actually does also that in this region. But in this very middle region, it goes bananas. You increase the amount of particles, and water moves faster. You know, a dream come true for traffic jams. You know, you just increase the particles. When you saw that, because this will be obtained by computer simulations, but also experiments back up that, we were very confused how water can do that. And what we realized is very fascinating. The water is doing all the time the four bonds. So when you pack, actually, you bring the fifth and the sixth neighbor. You understand? I have my four bonds made, but suddenly there is one particle just very close by, just a bond distance that I can shuffle and I can move. And even more fascinating than that, we found that because it's so durational, the linkage, the hydrogen bonds, that the particles rotate. It's not only moving fast, they are spinning, it's like a dance. They are going and they are rotating to accommodate the hydrogen bonds. And the beautiful thing is that the particles that move faster are not the ones rotating, are the neighbors rotating. You know, the ones that are as old as me might remember the old films in which you have the stairs and some beautiful men and women are going down the stairs. And the other people are doing just like that. And exactly what water does. You know, the molecule go and then the other ones get packing, they just bend and they rotate around, and the hydrogen bonds that just can accommodate that. So water diffuses faster when the density increase. And the number of hydrogen bonds, they keep more or less the same, but the number of neighbors change because it's more dense. And that's the way water does that. It's like if you could walk in a shopping center full of people, grabbing the people around you. Don't do that. Okay, now is a new thing, and that's fascinating. I'm not talking about diffusion is doing that. Now I'm going to talk about flow. Flow means that you go from one way straight like that, like when you open the sink in your house, you have water flowing. And the flow of particles is old physics, and normal flow is old physics. Everybody knows almost everything about that. However, I always have a however. However, when you make a nanotube, you know, nanometer, not your sink, it's very tiny, tiny sink. When you make a nanometer, the water flows inside up to 900 times faster than would flow if the equations that govern your sink in our house would work. Wow, that's impressive, you know. It's something like that. It gets aligned because it's so packed that it just goes like crazy. It doesn't have the signed hydrogen bonds to be committed to, so just flow like you would have a flowing of a tube inside another tube. So flows very fast. There are particles that love water, and there are particles that hate water. And here is just a cartoon illustrating why a particle would love water. And the reason why it would love water, because remember the dipoles. Water is basically dipoles. So when I have sodium, the sodium is positive. So once all this polarization around, so when you have your favorite sodium chloride in water, what happens that the sodium and chloride, they split apart, and each one just gets this beautiful dress of water all around them. So charged particles love water, and they don't want to get rid of this cover of water. But there are materials, non-charged materials, they dislike water. And here just I'm giving an example of a type of sand that's just don't like, and they form these bubbles because they just want to get rid of this water from them. And probably in your sofa in your house, you have a cover with some type of polymers that hate water. So more or less, the materials are either hating water or loving water. And you have to learn how to play with this game, love, hate, but I think that we already learned when we are in high school. Okay, now I'm coming to talk about splitting water from salt because we need fresh water. And I'm going to mention, just a cartoon mention, I have this claim there, the real process is much more complicated than that. But the mechanism I'm trying to illustrate. One way to separate water from salt is called thermodistillation. You have done an experiment in high school, in your time of high school. And what you do is that you heat water, you evaporate water, the salts left behind, and then you cool down, and you have water again here. What's the difficulties with this method? It's in place. Many countries, they use that if they have no other resources. The major problem is that the cost of energy. You have to heat all this water. The second problem is that you are left with a lot of salt, what you're going to do with the salt. Okay, so, but this is a method that is working. It has the advantage that you can do huge amount as soon as you have a lot of oil to burn and to heat this water. But if you have it, you can do that and separate salt from water in the sea. And they have many names, the moot effect distillation, moot stage, vapor compressions, but basically all those methods is heating water and getting some clean water. Another strategy is reverse osmosis. But before going to reverse osmosis, let me explain osmosis, okay? If you have a tank separated by a membrane that will not allow salt to cross, the natural tendency for the system to equilibrate is that the water from the low salt concentration, you move to the other side to dilute the salt. That's equilibrium. In the same way as if someone comes to this room with a nice perfume, in minutes, the perfume will dominate all the room. You know, the particles diffuse until we reach equilibrium. They try, even though we have a membrane, to reach equilibrium. The idea of reverse osmosis is to do something else, is to use this membrane but compress the side in which you have this high concentration salt and force it in a way that the water will go to the free water place. Of course, we have here to have energy to do that. Second, you have to clean and change this membrane all the time because this membrane is going to be attached not only with salt because you can charge the membrane to evolve the salt, but usually seawater have plenty of other stuff that is going to glue in the membrane. So this is a method. It's have been used, particularly regions in which is low salt concentration and regions in which you don't have a lot of biomolecules around. What I want to point out in both methods is that neither the thermodistillation nor the reverse osmosis is using any craziness of water. If you would replace water for other material there, the method would be absolutely the same. So it's not taking advantage of any of the properties of water. But now I'm going to bring some ideas for the future. And some of those ideas I'm bringing is for the near future. So for the near future, people are thinking, not only our group, many groups on the planet are thinking, in ways in which you can use the weirdness of water to get more fresh water. And here I'm putting a few examples. One is to use nanotubes. Another one is to copy from our body, taking aquaporin, that is a kind of tube that separates salts from water. Then membrane distillation, and also to use hydrophobic, hydrophilic, playing with love and hate water. Let me go one by one. So the first idea is to remember the film I show about the huge flux of water inside a nanotube. What the people are playing now is to building huge nets of these nanotubes, and because the water flows fast, the salt cannot enter. And the salt cannot enter in any tube because the salt wants to keep the beautiful dress of water. Remember, salt has this cover, but to enter the tube, it's facing this dielectric discontinuity that's huge, so the salt wants to stay behind, and the water can go, and the water goes faster. Obviously, nanotubes you cannot find in a nearby supermarket, and particularly you have to control the size and the length, because I hide from you, of course, that to this to work well, we have to have two nanometers diameter nanotubes, and they have to be perfect, and they have to be long. And you have to make a huge networks completely controlled. But as soon as these little details get fixed, you are going to get a wonderful way to filter. This method cannot solve yet the problem that we are going to dirt, you know, the nanotubes with the biomaterials. That's still, we need some more clever ideas to go. Now let's go to the membrane distillation. Membrane distillation is a very, because already 2 seconds ago I showed you that, so you already forgot, like my students, they usually do that. And let's remind you about that. That was, you heat, you make vapor, and then you make liquid, okay? So someone have a clever idea that let's take the same membrane. Remember, the membrane I push like that. It's a lot of strength just to pass because you have the salt on the side. But let's heat it. When I heat it, actually, what I have is vapor. And vapor flows quicker in the membrane. In addition to that, let's put a lot of nanotubes that hate water, the carbon nanotubes, they don't like water, inside the membrane. So we are using 2 tricks. One trick is the fact that vapor flows faster, and the second trick is to infiltrating these nanotubes that don't need to be as organized or as neaty as the previous one. They can be even a little bit random distributed, and they will make it, you know, less energy to force that. Still not in the market, still some research to do, but that's one of the possibilities. Now let's go again to osmosis. If you don't learn osmosis or osmosis tonight, you're not going to learn it. Never. So another idea about that, instead of using this reverse osmosis, let's use the natural osmosis. In the side in which you have little, just water, let's have seawater. And in the other side, let's put lots of salt. But really, lots of salt. But not normal salt. The trick will be to put green salt. Let's put some salt that actually don't like water that much, and that is very easy to evaporate. So what we do is that have salt, lots of salt. So water will flow naturally to dilute the salt, and then you heat that a little bit, and just a little bit, not too much, not to evaporate water, but to evaporate salt. And this call forward, contrary to reverse, osmosis, and the trick is to have this good green salt, yet not in the market. Green salt's not that easy, it's not a lot of small problems on it, but it's a possibility, and yet it's using some very intriguing and interesting properties of water, the fact that water don't like that much, this green salt. But now if you don't have salt, if you don't have seawater, you don't have sea around you, what you do? You know, in one of this desalination conference, someone asked this question: if I am in this small village in a very dry area, what should I do? You know, with all the resources of using this huge energy to do all this desalination without a sea close by? And there was no answer. It seems that there is not much to do. But yes, there is. And we can learn from nature. This is a beetle living in the desert of Africa. The country is Namibia, but I always say it wrong. But anyway, this beetle lives in a place that is hot during the day, but overnight gets cooler. And you have a lot of moisture in the air. So we have vapor of water in the air. In the back of this beetle, there is a lot of things that's not showing properly in the figure. In the top of that is a region that loves water, loves, loves, loves water. And in the bottom, there is a region that hates water. So the region that loves water, loves so much, that transforms vapor into liquid. So gives the energy necessary to make the phase transition. And then by gravity, it goes down to the region that hates water. And then it's like in your sofa, it's not being absorbed. So the animal bend, and the water goes, bend much more than I'm allowed to bend here, and go directly to the mouth. It's not great, it's beautiful. Many civilizations, for instance, in Peru, in South America, in the past, they have been using that hydrophilic, love water, hate water, and gravity. But to make a mountain enough for us, and not for a beetle, you have to have huge towers, because we need a lot of gravity on that. So I said, maybe there is an easy way around. Maybe we can combine things. Combine flow fast in nanotubes with love and hating water. And now, even though my collaborators didn't allow me to do that, but I'm doing anyway because I'm a very disobedient person, I show you the picture of what is this. This is a nanotube cutted. The pink is vapor, the red is liquid, the orange loves water, and the gray hates water. And when you do that, you just push particles, vapor, that get red, and as soon as they get red, they go to the hydrophobic, and they run away. And of course, because I don't want to spend a lot of things in simulations, I vanish with the particles as soon as they reach the side, the other side of the box. So this is a possibility for getting fresh water in a place in which you don't have your favorite seashore around. So thank you very much.
That was wonderful. That was wonderful. Thank you very much. Well, all right, we'll open the floor to questions. So if you do have a question, you can form a line here at the microphone. And I'll start with a question from, at Greg_Dick. I want to know, when did you become hooked by water? Your passion is unbelievable. Water hooked you. How young were you? What did it?
Oh, no, it's just 15 years ago, and I completely refused to say the age. But the reason why I was hooked by water is that I start to read about the lack of water in the planet. And I say, the answer for that have to be in water. You know, water have to be the answer for its own, you know, problem, unusual, and how, so we have to understand water. Of course, I am a theoretical physicist, I'm not experimental, so the easy way for me is to do simulations. So my playground is playing with water in the computer.
Very good, thank you. All right, there's another question from the Twitter feed from @potential, and wants to know, what exactly happens when something is hydrophobic?
Well, hydrophobic means that you're not attracted, you're not making this polarization. So the particles are not driven, you're not breaking the bonds, you're not competing with the bonds of water. So when I show the picture of this carbon nanotubes, it's hydrophobic, so it's not breaking, you know, the bonds that water is doing with water. Contrary to hydrophilic, in which you break, water prefers to be grabbed to the surface than grab to its own water. So water is happy with water and not happy grabbing that, simply because the electrostatic don't bring you there. It's all electrostatic on that.
Thank you. And back to the Twitter feed, another question. How do hydrogen and oxygen atoms naturally come together to form water, a water molecule? How did Earth get its water?
Okay. What I was explaining, I have this, the oxygen, and the oxygen, by quantum effects, want to make the electrons of valence want to make an octamer, means they are happy if they have 8 electrons. However, the oxygen just have 6. There are many ways to complete. It's like a Lego. You can complete this 8, for instance, by bringing another oxygen and binding twice. So it's one way to do that. But then simple way, that's why it makes water, is to bring one from oxygen and another one from hydrogen, another one from another hydrogen. And remember, in the universe, you have plenty of hydrogen, so there are a lot around, so you can complete, so you get 8. You get 8 because you borrow an electron from one hydrogen, and then you borrow another electron, and that's the covalent bond that's made.
Very good, and let's do one last question from the Twitter feed. I'll paraphrase. When and was there a eureka moment when you were looking at your graph?
It's not like you get there. I don't know what the limit of age of this public, but it's more or less like that. You try one thing, you try another thing, and finally, because you look to the graph, I said, the bones are being broken. That's why you get the mobility. And I was counting the bones, and they're not breaking. Then I got, it's the number of neighbors, and that was the Eureka. You know, it's just the possibility of making the bonds. And then I said, wow, that's a wonderful feeling. You know, just a wonderful feeling.
What a terrific finish. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Marcia Barbosa.